Stu Does America.
Joe Biden is an elderly man with a poor memory. Yes, it's true. And he's also, well, we put that on a cup. So that's what we do here. StuDoesMerch.com, StuDoesMerch.com. The code is Stu10. Get 10% off your order. We've got the t-shirts, got the mugs. Go check it out. Also check out YouTube, YouTube.com/StuDoesAmerica. Be sure to like and comment on the videos and hit the bell for notifications. Warren Kinsella is here with a warning about how radical these anti-Israel protesters are becoming. Alec Baldwin deals with a protester in his own, most Alec Baldwin way imaginable. Although I don't think he actually shot anyone, so it's not maybe the most Alec Baldwin way imaginable, but it was pretty Alec Baldwin-like. But we're going to start, though, by doing Trump on trial. And yes, we are in the middle of the first time the president, a former president, has ever been on trial for anything like this. It is a crazy, crazy moment in our history. And there's so much to go through and kind of keep you up to date on, because obviously this matters. It matters even though it shouldn't even be in court. We still have to talk about it because it affects all of our lives and the future of the American republic. It really does. A judge is skewering Trump defense credibility in gag order hearing against ahead of a witness testimony. The DA's office is seeking the maximum $1,000 fine for each of the 10 posts it says violated the order, along with an order that Trump remove the post from his social media platform. Also warns Judge Marchand to warn Trump any future violations risk not just additional fines, but also as long as 30 days in jail. Okay, I mean, and let's be clear about it. Every one of these tweets is worth, truths, is worth more than $1,000 to Donald Trump. So he'll just keep doing this as long as he can and get away with $1,000. Now, is it worth $87 million? Like, you don't see him bashing E. Jean Carroll too much these days, likely because $87 million was too high of a price. $1,000 per message? He can fit a lot in a Truth Social, usually in caps. And he walked out of the courtroom and did just that. Highly conflicted, to put it mildly, Judge Juan Merchan has taken away my constitutional right to free speech. Now, it's weird he's saying that on social media. So he's trying to take it away, though it does not seem to be successful. Everybody's allowed to talk and lie about me, but I am not allowed to defend myself. This is a kangaroo court, and the judge should recuse himself. All fair points, frankly, from Donald Trump on that one. They are trying to do this. This is a really BS kangaroo court. Of course, the media is going to be there to assist in every way imaginable to try to make this a nice, smooth landing for Alvin Bragg and all of his accusations. And, like, I want you to focus on the framing of this here. Because we can sit here and say that the media is liberal or the media is progressive and the media is after Trump. And all that's true. But, like, how do they do it? It's not just even lying a lot of times. It's just the framing of the story. Now, here's a situation where we have a case that really no one knows how it's going to come out. We don't know. I mean, it's the weakest of the cases. That's pretty much agreed upon by experts, legal experts and watchers alike. So you have that as a setup. Well, does that mean they're going to get a conviction? I mean, you know, the chances of that are still pretty high. You've got a Manhattan jury, you've got a judge and a system that is obviously not exactly favorable to Donald Trump. So, but I mean, this is certainly a case that could go either way, you know, depending on how you look at it. I've heard really smart people say they think it's going to be a hung jury. I mean, like this, they only need one of these jurors to get in there and say, hey, no, I think this is BS. Well, let me give you how that's the actual setup. I mean, I'm telling you, it could go either way. It could. How does the New York Times summarizes this or makes the exact same point I just made, which is there's a lot going on here. We don't know how this is going to turn out. OK, how do they frame it? Like this? Will a mountain of evidence be enough to convict Trump? In other words, he should be convicted. We all know that. And we all know there's a mountain of evidence. But because of the unfair system, maybe he won't even get a conviction out of this. That's the framing from The New York Times. And you see how they do this all the time. They're doing it to him. And I'm telling you, we've been talking about this for weeks. People don't like that I bring this up, but it's true that they have had a 6-month campaign here to try to make the economy look better and to try to make Donald Trump look worse. And these polls have and are tightening. And you could say, well, I don't believe the polls, but did you believe him when he was up by 6 points? Did you believe him when he was up by 7 points in some of these swing states? I mean, you don't know. It doesn't mean for sure the outcome is here. And I don't necessarily believe that this trend will continue with the American people. There may not be any low-hanging fruit to grab. But if you thought it was going to be a blowout, I think that's unlikely. Let me give you some of the things that the New York Times is saying. They had a quick little review. I'll give it to you quickly. In case, you know, you see these trials and you're like, all right, I know, you might even say, I know this is BS, but like, I don't know the ins and outs of it. Let me just go through this here real quick with you. The criminal trial of Donald Trump in Manhattan, historic trial, of course, beginning. Facing 34 counts of falsifying business records in the first degree to cover up a sex scandal, is on trial in Manhattan. He's the first former president. You know that. Now, 34 felony counts. I want to come back to that here in a second. What is Trump accused of? The charges trace back to a $130,000 hush money payment that Trump's fixer, Michael Cohen, made to the porn actress Stormy Daniels in 2016 to suppress her story of a sexual liaison with Trump in 2006. While serving as president, Trump reimbursed Cohen, and how he did so constituted fraud, prosecutors say. So it's important to understand this is not about the actual payment. It's not about whether he slept with Stormy Daniels, okay? It's not about that. He denies that, you know, you can believe that if you want. Then you have, well, is it about the payment? No, it's not really about whether he paid off Stormy Daniels to shut up or not, the hush money of the hush money trial. Doesn't really matter at all here, honestly. And like, that's the type of thing that you might look at that and say, you know, I don't know, maybe I don't want a president who is buying off porn stars a week before the election. That might be your thing. If so, the voting booth is a good place to exercise those demons that you might be holding around, because that is something that the American people can factor into a decision, right? That's not a legal issue, though. The idea that he paid off Stormy Daniels $130,000 to shut up before the election, none of that is actually on trial here at all. It's important to understand that, because they call it the hush money trial because they want you to think about this is a seedy act, right? Not exactly the thing that you might want out of a president. But that's not what is what the case is made up of here. Why did prosecutors cite other hush money payments? Although the charges relate only to the payment to Daniel. So you'll hear a lot about McDougal. You'll hear a lot about this doorman who accused Trump of fathering a child that was later proven to be false. That's all on the board. That all happened. They'll talk about it a lot, but it has nothing to do with the case. Although the charges relate to Stormy Daniels, the Manhattan district attorney is expected to highlight two other hush money deals. Prosecutors say the deals show that Trump had orchestrated a wide-ranging scheme to influence the 2016 presidential election. And a lot of people will say, well, you know, look, he did these things. He slept with these porn stars and Playboy bunnies and all of this. And it shows that he's guilty. And you might say, well, if he wasn't guilty, then they wouldn't even go after him on this stuff. If he didn't sleep with these women, they wouldn't even go after him. That's an interesting theory. However, we do know that the doorman who accused Trump of fathering a baby out of wedlock with, someone who worked at the, I think it was a young girl who worked at, I can't remember the exact details of it. The reason why I can't is because it wasn't true. Like, it was later proven to be false. So even though that was proven to be false, it's still being brought up in the prosecution of Donald Trump, because they will use basically anything to go after him. Who will the key witnesses be? Michael Cohen. Well, I've told you, and this is back when he was working for Donald Trump, is the least reliable speaker in the United States. And I'm talking about a place that Adam Schiff lives in, okay? This guy is not a reliable actor in any way. And that is not a new theory for me. I'm not saying that to defend Donald Trump. I'm telling you it because it is true. Michael Cohen does not tell the truth very often, okay? If he does, I believe it's a mistake on his part. He's trying to lie, but mistakenly tells the truth. That is basically who Michael Cohen is. He's their lead witness. He's the guy you need to rely on if you believe this story. They will also say, bring David Pecker. He's on the stand today, former publisher of the National Enquirer, as well as Hope Hicks, a former Trump aide, to shed light on the tumultuous period surrounding the payments. Trump plans to testify in his own defense. We'll see about that. I mean, he's saying that, but I don't know if I buy that. Who's the judge? Juan Merchan. Judge is veteran of the bench, known as a no-nonsense, drama-averse jurist. Bull crap, New York Times. It might be what he was known like as before, in a bunch of meaningless trials that nobody followed. But in this one, he is not a drama-free justice. He's been anything but so far. During the trial, Justice Merchan will be in charge of keeping order in the courtroom and ruling on objections made by prosecutors and Trump's lawyers. The jury will decide whether Trump is guilty and what happens if Trump is convicted. The charges against Trump are all Class E felonies, the least severe category in New York. If convicted, Trump faces a prison sentence of 4 years or less, or he could receive probation. Again, it's not, I mean, these aren't even felonies. They're not even felonies under the law. He's reaching to get to that point. Maybe we'll go through that here in a little bit as well. Now, as far as the charges against him, there's 34 charges against him, which means he did something wrong 34 times. That's really bad. 34 sounds like a lot. Of course, in reality, it's not really 34. Mr. Trump faces 34 felony counts and up to 4 years behind bars. But more than just his freedom is at stake. If convicted, he might lose the right to vote, including to cast a ballot for himself. That's part of the reason why they want to do this, because they want to embarrass him. He can't even vote for himself. He's such a criminal. If he were to win back the White House, he would be the first convicted criminal to serve as commander in chief. And the question of how he might serve a prison sentence, should it come to that, if he does not receive probation, could throw the country into turmoil. Now, I don't think, it's hard to imagine that they would put him in prison while he's actually the president of the United States. But hey, anything's on the table with these people at this point. Mr. Cohen has said he acted at Trump's direction. But look, that's probably true. Right? These payments, there's audio recordings of him talking about the McDougal case. When Cohen came out and admitted this went on, it wasn't an immediate firing. What are you talking about? I didn't have anything to do with those payments. Trump kept him around and was buddy-buddy with him for a while after that. I mean, it's just hard to imagine that these payments were not at Trump's behest. But again, that is not what is at stake here. It's not what has been he's been charged with. So it doesn't really matter if he was involved in it. The former president has not charged over the payment itself. Instead, he stands accused of covering up the transaction by disguising reimbursements to Mr. Cohen. In internal records, Mr. Trump's company marked those payments as legal expenses, citing a retainer agreement, yet no such expenses existed, prosecutors say, and the retainer agreement was fictional. Now, here's the important part about the 34 cases, because you'd say, okay, 34 cases sounds like a lot. This is the legitimate breakdown, okay? I'm not making this up. This is from the New York Times. And I know you would normally say, well, if you're reading it from the New York Times, it can't possibly be true. But this part is actually true. Mr. Trump is accused of engineering, or at least approving, the cover-up. His company, prosecutors argue, produced 34 false records that underpin the counts against him. 11 checks, 11 monthly invoices Mr. Cohen submitted, and 12 entries in the general ledger for Mr. Trump's trust. Now, that does add up to 34. However, what we're talking about is one thing. There was one payment, and then he broke up the payment into 12 pieces to space it out over a year. And so 11 checks, then 11 invoices. He had to be invoiced by Cohen. Again, how is that Mr. Trump's crime, right? How is that Trump's crime if it's Cohen submitting invoices? Seems like that would be potentially Cohen's crime if he was submitting false invoices. But he submitted a false invoice, and I guess because he signed it and because they went through the, and again, a lot of the stuff wasn't even signed by Trump. It didn't even go through him, but that's a whole other story. And then the 12 general ledger. Now, I got news for you. Donald Trump is not hanging around his general ledger and actually making entries into it. That's not the way the Trump organization works. But they're going to get him on 34 things because they're inflating it, right? They want to make it seem overwhelming. 34 cases, that's quite a lot. Now, the New York Times, horrible, horrible coverage there, though some of the stuff they've done actually has been decent. In fact, I can't believe they even allowed this one to be printed. I thought the Bragg case against Trump was a legal embarrassment. Now I think it's a historic mistake. This is a guest essay from today. And let me just give you some of this because it's pretty amazing. As a reality check, it is legal for a candidate to pay for a non-disclosure agreement. Hush money is unseemly, but it is legal. The election law scholar Richard Hassan has rightly observed, calling it election interference actually cheapens the term and undermines the deadly serious charges in real election interference cases. And this is an interesting part of this because to get you to the point where Trump is at trial, a bunch of hurdles had to be cleared by Alvin Bragg. Number one, the statute of limitations had already expired because he came into office and did not take the case right away. He thought it wasn't worthy. He then got pressured into taking it, basically. At least that's what everyone believes. So he decided to do it. And he went forward with the case. The problem with that, of course, is the case itself, the business records offenses he's charged with, are misdemeanors. What would that even mean, right? Like nothing big. If he got charged with a misdemeanor, I don't think anybody would even care. However, what they had to do to get it from a misdemeanor up to a felony charge, and of course also to get rid of the statute of limitations issues that they had, was they had to tie it to another crime. Basically, New York law says, hey, you can get past those little hurdles if you can show the business records thing was to hide another crime. So, for example, if you were if Michael Cohen instead had killed Stormy Daniels, assassinated her, and they said, hey, we're tying that to the Stormy Daniels assassination and murder charges, he also falsified records in to pursue that, then you'd have a reason to get those up to a felony and to get rid of the statute of limitations. The problem with this, of course, is they can't even identify which law Trump supposedly broke that was a felony that would increase the charges to a felony when it comes to the business records part of it. They don't even name it. They're saying this generic election interference thing, which isn't an actual specific crime that they're citing. They're just kind of citing it generally. And secondarily, Trump hasn't been charged with any of that in this case. So not only are they citing a law that they can't even name, but that law has not been violated, at least according to the people that could charge him for violating it. Kind of an issue. Mr. Trump's lawyers argue that the New York statute requires that the predicate, the underlying crime, must also be a New York crime, not a crime under another jurisdiction. This is yet another problem with their case. Bragg is saying, okay, well, there's a federal election interference crime that he was pursuing, so therefore we can charge him in these New York crimes. But in reality, he has no control over those other crimes. He has no jurisdiction over those other crimes. Perhaps if he had violated a New York law, maybe he'd have a better argument, but he doesn't even have that going on. The Manhattan DA responded with judicial precedents only about other criminal statutes, not the statute in this case. In the end, this is important, they could not cite a single judicial interpretation of this particular statute supporting their use of the statute. Is that an issue? They couldn't even come up with one? Not one example as to how other people have done things this way before? Nope, not even one. Ends with this. 8 years after the alleged crime itself, it is reasonable to ask if this is more about Manhattan politics than New York law. This case should serve as a cautionary tale about broader prosecutorial abuses in America and promote bipartisan reforms of our partisan prosecutorial system. I mean, it is a good point because you know what? Donald Trump is the one right now who's at the wrong side of all of this. But who's to say that an enterprising Republican won't turn the tables the same way on Democrats later on? We could be into a lawfare republic where every election is decided by who sues most successfully and who gets the other criminals charged with crimes before the election even occurs and people are able to actually vote. And if that doesn't sound pro-democratic, and I mean that with the concept of voting rather than the party, if that doesn't sound pro-democratic to you, you're probably pretty sane. Because to me, it sounds pretty anti-democratic. For the party that constantly tells us that democracy is at stake here, gosh, they're doing a lot to get the other guy off the ballot, to get the other guy thrown in prison, to get the other opponents tossed, whether they're third parties or primary opponents, tossed off the ballot. Like, democracy can't exist when one name is on a ballot. Yet that's what they want. And you might be thinking to yourself, well, the left would do anything at this point to get rid of Donald Trump short of killing him. And I understand why you'd say that. However, I do think it is important not to jump to conclusions, at least on that last part, because I don't know. Do they want him dead? They talk like they want him dead, but what evidence do you have of that? That's a pretty serious accusation. I mean, what possible evidence could you have to say that they just want Donald Trump to be dead? How about this? Former January 6th panel chair seeks to strip Secret Service protection from felons. Dubbed the denying infinite security and government resources allocated toward convicted and extremely dishonorable former President Protectees Act, this is called the Disgraced Act, the legislation from Benny Thompson would nix the lifelong protection given to former presidents if they are convicted and sentenced for a felony that carries a year or more in prison time. What possible reason could you have to not protect the president, former president of the United States, if he were to go to prison? What do you think would happen in that situation? What do you think the worry would be? Do you think, I mean, have you ever seen an episode of a jailhouse drama before? Have you ever watched HBO? We all know what goes on in prison. And if you have no protection for a president of the United States, you can be sure someone in prison will try to make a name for themselves, taking out the former president. My guess is Benny Thompson's aware of that. He probably has HBO Max. He probably has the Max app on his phone. He's probably well aware what might happen to Donald Trump if this were to pass. And yet he's proposing it for what? What other possible reason could he be? He's very transparent that this is about Donald Trump, right? Donald Trump's going to go to prison. I don't want to give him Secret Service protection. Why? Why? Why won't you give Secret Service protection to RFK Jr.? Why? Why is that? It seems like they just want their opponents dead. And I got to say, there's a lot of evidence supporting that claim right now. And when you look at some of the Hamas protesters on campus that support people on the left, I don't know. It starts to make you think a little bit. You got to be a little worried, I suppose, of these things. And when they want to do it through the law, basically, it should make you even more suspicious and worried for the future of this country. Just like it was back during the pandemic, we're facing a drug and medical supply shortage in the U.S. today. I have a friend who had to go all over the city to try to find medication he needed. All over the city. He had to call people. He had to hire someone to call around to find medication at pharmacies because he had called like 10 or 20 himself, and they had to keep calling all over until he had to go about 45 minutes away to find the medication that he needed. That's not America. It shouldn't be America. The Jace case is here to help you work with some of those issues because it provides five life-saving antibiotics for emergency use. Now, some of these antibiotics have been in shortage. Some of them right now are okay, but you don't know where they're going to be or in the future. Basically, if you don't know the history of antibiotics, they knock out a lot of big things that people get infected with all the time that used to kill us. Now, they don't anymore because of antibiotics. Well, if those things go away, you could be in some serious trouble. So go to Jace Medical and just empower yourself to take care of your own health care. JaceMedical.com. Use the code STU at checkout. Get a discount on your order. The promo code is STU at JaceMedical.com. J-A-S-E Medical.com. I've been talking a lot about the protests, the anti-Israel, pro-Hamas types of protests around the country, all over really North America. And talking about how crazy it's getting and their tactics becoming more and more extreme. One of the things I pointed to was a manual that came up of really discussing their tactics, how they work, how they hide their crimes, really disturbing stuff. It was based on an article by Warren Kinsella. He's an attorney and columnist and has a new column out at the Toronto Sun. It's called Anti-Israel Protesters Becoming More Radical, Openly Embracing Terror Groups. I'll tweet out a link to that shortly. You should definitely see it. Warren, how's it going?
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on and discussing this. Before we get into the content of the manual, which is crazy, how did you get your hands on this thing?
I got it from a source. And, you know, as you know, you got to check this stuff out. So I got in touch with this organization. They're mainly based, but not exclusively based, in Britain. And they confirmed that they are the author of this document, which is tantamount to terrorism. And I asked them questions about what's in it. They said they couldn't answer because it's the subject of some criminal prosecutions in Britain. I checked that out and that was also true. So it's the real deal. These guys have put down in black and white, they've put down in writing, you know, the crimes that they commit and they're proudly committing in the service of their anti-Israel cause.
It really is amazing. And it's getting more and more extreme. And it's not just about the damage they want to do, though that is part of this as well. It's also about disguising their crimes, hiding from police, hiding evidence, making sure they're not recognized. I mean, it goes through the entire pathway you'd expect from any terrorist group to hide what they're doing. Can you kind of give us an outline as to what is in this manual?
Well, they're using precisely that manual of, you know, how terrorist groups used to operate. In Europe in the 70s, you had groups like Abu Nidal, the Red Army faction, of course, the Irish Republican Army, and they all adopted what Palestine Action recommends that these groups do, which is form a cell of no more than three or four people. It minimizes the possibility of police infiltration. It minimizes the possibility of leaks. And they've structured themselves in the way that these terrorist cells do. And what they go on to describe in their manual is how to commit a wide range of crimes, serious crimes, in both Canada and the United States and Britain. And, you know, it's pretty out there. It's something that I've never seen before, but it just demonstrates how bold and brazen these groups are getting.
I mean, you write in your article, break-ins are advised by Palestine Action because breaking into your target and damaging the contents inside is obviously a very effective tactic. Cells are advised to map out escape routes well in advance using a variety of means. Cells are also used to only use cash when buying equipment, whether it's spray paints or sledgehammers, and never leave a paper or digital trail. These are the types of things that if you were arrested, if any of the police anywhere in North America were arresting people anymore for crimes like this, would be the basis of a very effective prosecution. You'd be able to show all this. They're doing everything they can to hide it from police.
That's right. And some of the things that they advise, for example, cutting through pipes at some facility that they think is assisting Israel in some way and filling it with concrete. I mean, you can just put your mind ahead to the consequences of that. That could lead to people being seriously hurt or people even killed, depending on the kind of facility that you're talking about. And the one thing they emphasize is, and this is what we're seeing in the streets, we're seeing in Colombia, you know, we're seeing at universities all around North America and Western Europe, in fact, you know, cover your face, cover your body so they can't see your tattoos and your birthmarks. Be careful what shoes you wear, right? Because they could be matched against the shoes that you put up on social media. Use cash, as you said, use burner phones. Like it really is a how-to manual about how to carry out terror tactics.
Yeah, you mentioned they're very focused on the shoes. So this is a big part of the manual, which was, I thought, interesting. I guess they think police really look at your shoes. If that's true, I did not know. I didn't know that this was the case, but they do talk about that quite a bit. What I find fascinating about this, Warren, is that, like, I don't know, I had this weird picture growing up in the United States of America, and Canada certainly is part of this, that we have a diverse group of people who agree and disagree on a lot of different things, but we all kind of live together and have a civilized society. We understand that maybe political elections are the way to handle our differences, and there's always debate and conversation, but it shouldn't be leading to terrorism and destruction of property. And we have seen groups, the Weather Underground here in the U.S., you've mentioned a couple of others today, that have violated that. But it used to be so rare and it used to be shunned by polite society. What has changed?
I think what we're seeing, you know, I've seen the data about where is this stuff coming from. And, you know, among old guys like me, most of us still support strongly a safe and secure Israel. We support Israel's right to defend itself against attacks like the terrible attack that took place on October 7th by Hamas. But among Gen Z, so, you know, people in Canada and the United States and Europe between the ages of about 18 and 24, and millennials between the ages of about 25 and 42, we're at risk of losing those generations. I've seen data that suggests that they not only don't care about what Hamas did, they support what Hamas did. They support the targeting of Jews in Canada and the United States. They support doing all that can be possibly done to wipe out the state of Israel. So if you look at the protests, and they are organized, right? They got professional organizers there. They're handing out food and drink. You know, they've got professionally rendered banners and signs, and they all tend to be young people. And, you know, this is where this propaganda campaign, this global propaganda campaign of which Palestine Action is part, has been so successful, is using TikTok and other platforms to reach, you know, younger North Americans, younger Europeans, and get them over to their side. That is a big problem, and that's something that we need to deal with as a society.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the social media aspect of this, because I think this is a fascinating part of it. There have always been groups that protest and maybe weren't all that educated about the topic they were talking about. I mean, we've seen this forever. This feels much different. And I don't know exactly if it's just, you know, we're certainly seeing a lot more of it because of social media. But another part of that seems to be there's a performative aspect to this, right? Like there's some sort of a point system that they've come together on that shows the more radical you are, the higher your score. And it seems like they're constantly playing this game with really serious consequences. And you wonder if, you know, people who are just getting to the point where they're understanding the world at all have any concept of how this is going to look later on and what this means to society.
Well, you know, look at the Columbia University kids. You know, I'm sure they all consider themselves social justice warriors at the moment. But I think you're right. You know, they're going to come to profoundly regret some of the choices they're making. But, you know, we as a society, from the politicians to the police to the prosecutors, need to take this stuff more seriously. You know, one of the most positive things that happened in the past few days is the House of Representatives saying TikTok, which is one of the principal platforms for anti-Semitism and anti-democratic themes on the planet, it needs to change its ownership structure, or, you know, it's going to be banned, as has happened in many jurisdictions in Canada and in the United States. So that's a good first step, but we're really behind the eight ball in dealing with these groups and this global propaganda movement, because there's a lot of money behind it coming out of places like Qatar and Iran. And obviously they're very organized and very effective at driving their message out. It's just about every night, you know, it's hard to imagine a night where you don't hear about some protest or attack or some anti-Semitic event taking place somewhere in North America. It seems to be happening every single day.
Mm. You know, it seems, you know, over the years, I've always had this impression of Canada and the United States having, you know, generally speaking, the same sort of principles and understanding of the world. Maybe when I look at some of the crazy things going on, Canada a little bit farther down the road than the U.S. I do think we're challenging you now at that. We seem to be, I don't know, maybe passing you. What are the state of protests in Canada right now?
I would love for you to be right, but statistically, if you look at the metrics, it actually is worse in Canada now than in the United States. In terms of, like, in Canada, we've had in Montreal, you know, Jewish day school, little kids shot up not once, but twice. We've had synagogues and Jewish community centers in Montreal being firebombed. We have Jewish delicatessens in Toronto being firebombed, Jewish homes in Winnipeg being shot up. We've got a big, big problem here. And a big part of the reason is, as I indicated, our politicians, our prosecutors, our police are not taking it seriously. And it's not like, you know, unlike in the United States, where you've got the First Amendment and you have a much more tough approach to free speech. You favor it much more than Canadians tend to. Despite us having a whole range of laws to apply, they're not being applied. And so what's happening is the bad guys are emboldened by that, and they're getting more and more brazen. They're getting more and more out there and more radical. And the Palestine Action Manual is a symptom of that. They're unafraid of us, and they're getting more and more out there. And it's something we need to take seriously.
I've got about a minute left, Warren, here. But, I saw a protest video in Canada where they were chanting, long live October 7th. This is not a pro-Palestinian protest. This is pro-Hamas. This is anti-Israel, anti-Jew. What do we do about this? Is there any way to solve it?
Yeah, well, I mean, that, just to contextualize that for your listeners and your viewers, that event, that parade that took place on Saturday, those pro-Hamas thugs wearing masks and paying tribute to Hamas and paying tribute to October 7th, you know, the slaughter of 1,200 men, women, children, and babies, that took place feet from the office of the Prime Minister of Canada. Like, it's, you imagine something like that taking place just outside of the White House. Like, it is completely unacceptable. Hamas in this country, in Canada, is a listed terrorist entity. Our criminal code forbids any kind of aid or support, material or rhetorical or otherwise, for listed terrorist entities. But those bad guys on Saturday, they're still walking the street with impunity, still doing what they were doing before. So again, you know, we've got the laws, we've got the cops, we've got the prosecutors. We need to use them in Canada and elsewhere, because the problem clearly is getting worse.
Warren Kinsella, the new article is in the Toronto Sun. It is anti-Israel protesters becoming more radical, openly embracing terror groups. You can see this material. He's got all the quotes from it in the article. Make sure to check this out. It's really important. Warren, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks, my friend.
some egress on High Street or Wall Street. No one will stop you from leaving. If you do not leave, you will be arrested. We will give you time to leave. If you do not leave, you will be arrested.
Uh-oh, there you go. NYPD arresting Gaza war protesters at NYU. In this case, a fresh U.S. campus flashpoint, says Axios. This is incredible that this is happening in our country. You know, we talk about this stuff all the time, and you think that, you know, a lot of this stuff has been really, really rough. Lots of anti-Semitism, lots of the worst in our society. And Glenn brought up this point this morning, which I thought was brilliant, honestly, that this is, you know, you saw the Joe Biden comments on this, where he said, look, you know, basically you have a situation here where, of course, I condemn the anti-Semitism. But, you know, I also condemn the other people, you know, who are, don't understand the Gaza situation. And like that, let me summarize that for you. There are very fine people on both sides. That is legitimately the exact same comment about a very similar situation where a group of protesters are talking badly about the Jews. It is the same story. Have you noticed any differences in the coverage? Have you? It is unbelievable. I know the lowest form of punditry is to call out the hypocrisy of all this, but I'm fine being down there today because it's just so infuriating. To Hawley and Cotton, Josh Hawley, Tom Cotton, call on Biden to deploy National Guard over Gaza protests at colleges. Both of them being consistent, by the way. They've called for this multiple times when this stuff has, you know, when chaos has broken loose. You might remember Tom Cotton writing an op-ed for the New York Times arguing, hey, yeah, maybe we should bring out the National Guard to put down all these protests during the George Floyd situation. That cost 1 zillion people their jobs at the New York Times, and now 14-year-old interns run the place. So that is basically how that one ended up. David Mamet is calling Hollywood's diversity efforts fascist totalitarianism. It's our latest example of a pre-cancellation alert. Congratulations to David Mamet. You'll soon be canceled. He kind of already has been canceled, though. He's been a little too sensible over the years anyway, but he says he's a big screenwriter, if you didn't know that. He says DEI is garbage. He told the New York Times. He said it was fascist totalitarianism. There's no room for an individual initiative, he said, of a film industry having experienced growth, maturity, decay, and death, especially in the wake of recent Hollywood writers' strike. There will be less work, but the scripts will be better, Mamet added. And he rejected that his children, starting Girls, ever got work because of their association with him. They earned it by merit. Nobody gave my kids a job because of who they were related to. And of course, they didn't cross offer nearly as many of the intersectional guidelines needed to book a role these days. So, of course. And speaking of actors, we have Alec Baldwin back in the news. He smacked a phone out of somebody's face. And I could tell you that, honestly, like a lot of times you'd think, oh, gosh, what, you know, here he is at it again, Alec Baldwin. But this one, he's talking about an anti-Israel agitator. And they wanted him to say free Palestine. There's this weird thing, weird hangup that these particularly Palestinian protesters, but also many of them on the left, have about forced speech. Like they want you to say the thing that they want you to say and you better say it. Well, they tried to do that to Alec Baldwin. Here's how that turned out.
Alec, can you please say free Palestine one time? Why did you kill that lady? You killed that lady and got no jail time? No jail time, Alec? No jail time, Alec. You're putting innocent people in jail, Alec Baldwin.
I'm so sorry.
Free Palestine, Alec, just one time, and I'll leave you alone. I'll leave you alone, I swear. Just say free Palestine one time. One time. One time.
Call the police.
One time, Alec. You know he's a criminal. You know he's a f***ing criminal. Come on, Alec, just say free Palestine one time. One time, just one time, please. And I'll leave you alone. Free Palestine. Israel, Zionism. Please say it. One time.
You know, normally I don't cheer on Alec Baldwin, but on that particular case, I'm completely fine with his actions. We are screwed up. When you absolutely, positively have to buy or sell a home, and you have to do it sometimes, it's part of life. Real Estate Agents I Trust is who you want on their side. This is Glenn's company. He started it a long time ago because he was tired of dealing with bad real estate agents. He had several of them in a row. He kept having problems selling his home. And, you know, look, when that hits you, you want a solution to it. Most people can't do anything about it. Glenn was like, yeah, I can do something about it. So he started this company, and they sort through real estate agents to give you the best ones in your area. These are the top sellers. They know the lay of the land. This is the, they know the best practices to keep you and your family where you need to go, whether it's across the street or across the country. So you got to have someone on your side, whether you're buying or selling a home. Remember that buying part, too. Don't just, you know, don't depend on the other person's real estate agent to take care of you. Have someone on your side. Go to realestateagentsitrust.com, realestateagentsitrust.com. Wherever you are in the country, this is a free service to you. realestateagentsitrust.com. So how was your Earth Day? Everything go okay? Get the, what we like to do is cut down a tree, bring it inside for Earth Day. And then we worship the tree, and then we burn it in a fire immediately afterward, letting the toxins rise up to the earth to clog the lungs of Mother Nature. That's just the way we celebrate. You could celebrate a different way. But there's a new study out, and this is important. Make sure you understand this. Climate change has a bigger impact on LGBTQIA2+ community members than straight couples. Mm-hmm. Here's how. Now, you might say, wait, yeah, that's a great question. How? How can that possibly be? Is it that maybe LGBTQIA2+ community members don't like the heat? Is it that they don't like the rain? There's a storm rolling in. They don't like that. What could it possibly be, right? Like, my understanding was, and this is a crazy understanding, but my understanding was LGBTQIA2+ community members, other than the fact that they like different things sexually, are kind of the same as other human beings. That's what I thought. But apparently I had the wrong idea because climate change hits them so hard. Well, how does that happen? They explain. It's unbelievable. This is from UCLA, by the way, School of Law and the Williams Institute. They say among the 15 counties researchers surveyed with the highest proportions of same-sex couples, all were coastal or urban. So the reason it hits LGBTQIA2+ community members is because they live close to the water. They have nice houses near the ocean, so they get more effect. Now, they go into this, and they also say they might be, they may have housing, healthcare, income, access to food issues. Now, of course, when you do the economic analysis of the LGBTQIA2+ community, many of them are higher earners than other communities. Then they have a higher net worth than other communities. You know, kids are expensive, and many of them do not have kids. That's not their priority. And that's fine, but that's also leads to some economic prosperity at times. The bottom line is, how ridiculous is this? I mean, if you're really an LGBTQIA2+ community member, and you're like, ah, gosh, climate change, here it comes, move to Kansas, and everything will be fine. Okay, so here's what happened. Guy in Belgium gets a DUI, and he wants to fight it, but he was hammered, so there's really no way for him to fight it unless the court entertained a very novel defense that he actually had ABS. Now, you might say, what's ABS? That's something to do with your bowels? No, not, well, kind of, but no. This is auto brewery syndrome, and the way this works is if you eat carbs, your body has a weird reaction to the carbs, and it turns the carbs into alcohol and makes you hammered, even though you didn't drink any alcohol. Now, this is it. He's now been cleared. Belgian man cleared, who makes his own alcohol, body makes his own alcohol, correct, cleared of drunk driving. I mean, I guess that's just, although it's kind of on you to be like a pretty adherent to the keto diet at that point, right? Like, you can't just have a loaf of bread and then go driving if you have this. I don't know if that's going to work. I will say, the lawyer had a tough case here because the client with auto brewery system actually works at a brewery. So I don't know. BlazeTV.com/stew. Promo code is stew. See you tomorrow.